Ladies and gentlemen, the sound you hear is a buzzsaw ripping through a painting of George Washington chopping down cherry trees. It's time for Professor Buzzkill, busting myths and taking names.
That's right, it is time for Professor Buzzkill. It's time for me, but I'm here this week because huge numbers of listeners have flooded the Buzzkill Institute with emails, faxes, texts, and tweets asking about President Donald Trump's executive orders. They've come so fast and furious, both the executive orders and the tweets. So in this episode, we'll explain the nature and operation of executive orders, as well as the history and mythology behind this fascinating aspect of American government. Students and other impressionable buzzkillers often ask me what executive orders are, and I usually tell them that they're directives from the president to government agencies, including the military, telling them how to implement laws and regulations that have already been passed by Congress. The idea is that congressional legislation shouldn't be overloaded with specific instructions about the, frankly, often mundane aspects of getting things done and getting regulations implemented. Sometimes Congress can't agree on how a law should be implemented, and so they leave that part of the legislation deliberately vague. And since old legislation might not have taken technological or other changes into account, executive orders are often needed to direct how certain laws are to be enforced in modern times. For the most part, the idea of executive orders and the existence of executive orders as part of the workings of government have not been too controversial in themselves. Sometimes the specific issue they're trying to address has been controversial, more on that later, but the constitutional role of executive orders usually has been accepted until, frankly, the late 20th century. It seems as if even the concept of having executive orders has become controversial since the early 1990s. If the opposition party controls Congress, they often complain that the executive orders are legislation by fiat and that the president at the time is using them in a dictatorial way. Republican legislators decry even the principle of executive orders when there's a Democratic president, and Democrats seem to do the same these days when there's a Republican president. Now let's go back to the Constitution, which each of the major political parties are fond of referring to when they think a president of the other party is going too far with executive orders. Article 2, Section 1, Clause 1 says, "The executive power shall be invested in a president of the United States of America." The executive power. And Article 2, Section 3, Clause 5 says that the president, quote, "shall take care that the laws be faithfully executed," unquote. Pretty simple, right? Well, it's also pretty vague. Or, to give the framers of the Constitution the benefit of the doubt, it's pretty general. And that's the main point I want to get across in this episode. The constitutional basis of, the history of, and the, certainly the practice of using executive orders is fairly open-ended and not specific. And ever since the time of George Washington, they've been used in all kinds of ways. You've already noticed, no doubt, that the phrase executive orders doesn't appear in the Constitution itself. It has arisen and developed over the history of the U.S. There are different types of executive orders, but again, the definition and use of the different types is not given in the Constitution. Many scholars argue that the framers deliberately left the idea of executive orders vague so that the operation of the government could be flexible when needed. This might especially be true since the early national government was not large and its scope was somewhat limited by the needs of the times. Other scholars argue that since executive orders as a phrase doesn't appear in the Constitution, they shouldn't be used. But they've been used often, buzzkillers, and by tradition they've developed into the following types: proclamations, which usually refer to ceremonial or symbolic things, such as National Buzzkiller Appreciation Day. The second one is national security directives, which are on defense issues. It might include the Defense Against Historical Myths Directive, and general, and I'm putting general in quotation marks here because I'm saying it, executive orders, including the one directing you to go to iTunes and rate and review yours truly. Again, this category shows how vague this whole practice is. But presidents haven't generally been too picky about which title they use when issuing an executive order. You'll notice in a few minutes that Eisenhower referred to one of his orders during the Little Rock school desegregation crisis as a proclamation, when indeed it was a lot stronger and more forceful of an order than something purely ceremonial. George Washington issued the first executive order on June 8, 1789. In it, he asked the heads of the various departments within the executive branch to report to him about what was going on in the country. Specifically, Washington ordered them to, quote, impress me with a full, precise, and distinct general idea of the affairs of the United States, end quote. Now, remember the 18th century language here, buzzkillers. By impress, Washington meant inform or impress upon me. And although, quote, full, precise, and distinct seemed to clash with general when asked for an, quote, idea of the affairs of the United States, end quote, we have to give Father George a break. His false teeth were probably slipping. Since then, all presidents, with the exception of William Henry Harrison, have issued executive orders to get things done. The ink was barely dry on Mrs. Harrison's inauguration party thank you notes when the president died more or less a month after taking office. Precious few executive orders, however, survive in the National Archives, partly because of poor record keeping. And the number of executive orders issued by presidents greatly increased in the 20th century, and whereas 19th century presidents usually issued fewer than 100 executive orders during their terms, Teddy Roosevelt started the tradition of using them frequently, issuing over 1,000 during his presidency. Talk about a bully pulpit. Generally speaking, executive orders have been used more frequently during times of war or national crisis. Ulysses S. Grant issued 217 executive orders during his presidency, whereas a total of 270 had been issued by all the presidents before him. He was trying to put the country back together after the Civil War and the controversial presidency of Andrew Johnson, frankly. FDR holds the record for numbers of executive orders issued by one president, 3,522. Now, FDR apologists and historical realists note that he was president for nearly 12 years. If we divide them by presidential terms of 4 years, the number of FDR executive orders issued is only a little higher than most other 20th century presidents. Okay, we're down in the advertising department of the Buzzkill Institute, and upstairs on the research division, they were talking about FDR and his executive orders, and it's a good thing we broke there because I can remind you, Buzzkillers, what a great customer and believer in Harry's Razors FDR was. He went to Harry's, he used the code Buzzkill at checkout, he got a great deal on the trial package, he brought the country out of the Depression and helped win World War II. There's no clearer example of cause and effect in world history. There's also another great buzzkiller out there that I'd like to talk about briefly, and that is Russ Hall at Penn State University. He's one of the librarians there, one of the research and reference librarians. He's been a buzzkiller forever, and we've relied on him a lot, especially when it comes to executive orders. When I used to work at Penn State, he and I would talk about them because I didn't really know a lot, and I'd have to ask him. He's an American history expert, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And the other day, he called me on the phone, and he said, Professor, what is it about Harry's? What's with you? You sound like a religious maniac. Your enthusiasm for Harry's beggars buzzkill belief, is it actually true? Are they really that good? And the answer is yes. I told him yes, the quality is absolutely fantastic. You know what I always say, the Harry's five-blade razors have a great soft flex hinge for more comfortable glide. They have a trimmer blade for hard-to-reach places that I use all the time. Lincoln used it to make it look, his beard look the way it looked. They have a lubricating strip and a textured handle for more control when it's wet. And he said, yeah, I know all that, but the enthusiasm in your voice. I said, my enthusiasm is there because I'm sick to death for centuries of getting ripped off by those other razor companies at what they charge, making small changes in their so-called blades and then jacking the price up. And you had to get the local flunky at the drugstore to open the Fort Knox cabinet so you could get into them. It was a huge process. Harry's doesn't do any of that. I said to him, Russ, their prices are still just $2 a blade compared to the $4 or more you pay at the drugstore. They do this because they own their own razor factory. They make the best, highest quality razors themselves, cut out the middleman, sell them online to you, Russ, and to other buzzkillers out there for half the price of the ripoff razor companies. So I've got an executive order for you, Buzzkillers. Harry's will send you their popular trial set for free when you go to harrys.com. The free trial set comes with a razor, 5 blade cartridge, and shaving gel. You just pay $3 or something for the shipping. Plus, just for my listeners, just for you Buzzkillers, enter the code Buzzkill, B-U-Z-Z-K-I-L-L, at checkout, and you get their post-shave balm for free. All the presidents have always said the post-shave balm is one of the best aspects of the Harry's experience, right? That's why they also look so good on television. You'll look better, and your face will feel better all day when you use it. Of course, your Harry's subscription plan is customizable in terms of shipping frequency, and you can cancel at any time. Remember, here's the executive order. Go to harrys.com. Enter the code BUZZKILL at checkout. You'll get a great razor, blades, shave cream, and the post-shave balm for free. Do it now. Start enjoying a whole new world of better and more affordable shaves. Now back upstairs to hear more about other executive orders. We're back, Buzzkillers. Careful recording of executive orders has only been around since 1907, when the State Department started numbering them. And they did something interesting when determining which executive order would be given the number one. They didn't use the one that was just about to come out. They didn't go back to Washington's Impress Me Directive of 1789. They gave Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation of October 20th, 1962, the distinction of being executive order number one in U.S. history. You'll remember, Buzzkillers, that the Emancipation Proclamation freed the slaves in the rebellious states during the Civil War. This backdating of executive orders to 1862 rather than 1789 is a fascinating historical fact of its own, but we don't have time to go into it. I'd like now to play for you three examples of 20th century presidents announcing executive orders to give you a feel of the widely ranging things that they have been used to cover. The first is President Eisenhower's speech in September 1957 about the necessity to issue an executive order to enforce the Supreme Court's ruling that public schools must be desegregated. The flashpoint in 1957 was at Little Rock High School in Arkansas. Eisenhower addressed the nation on television, telling Americans why he was federalizing the Arkansas National Guard and sending other federal troops to carry out the Supreme Court's orders. I'm going to play you a long extract from the beginning of the speech because Ike explains the executive order process clearly, or at least his conception of the executive order process, and emphasizes that it was an essential part of the duties of the office of the president in this instance.
Good evening, my fellow citizens. For a few minutes this evening, I should like to speak to you about the serious situation that has arisen in Little Rock. To make this talk, I have come to the president's office in the White House. I could have spoken from Rhode Island, or where I have been staying recently, but I felt that, in speaking from the House of Lincoln, of Jackson, and of Wilson, my words would better convey both the sadness I feel in the action I was compelled today to make, and the firmness with which I intend to pursue this course until the orders of the federal court at Little Rock can be executed without unlawful interference. In that city, under the leadership of demagogic extremists, disorderly mobs have deliberately prevented the carrying out of proper orders from a federal court. Local authorities have not eliminated that violent opposition. And under the law, I yesterday issued a proclamation calling upon the mob to disperse. This morning, the mob again gathered in front of the Central High School of Little Rock, obviously for the purpose of again preventing the carrying out of the court's order relating to the admission of Negro children to that school. Whenever normal agencies prove inadequate to the task, and it becomes necessary for the executive branch of the federal government to use its powers and authority to uphold federal courts, the president's responsibility is inescapable. In accordance with that responsibility, I have today issued an executive order directing the use of troops under federal authority to aid in the execution of federal law at Little Rock, Arkansas. This became necessary when my proclamation of yesterday was not observed, and the obstruction of justice still continues.
So Ike's announcement and orders were a serious reaction to a serious and potentially deadly situation. And I don't think anyone would disagree that executive order was needed at that point in 1957 in Little Rock. Executive orders have also been used to start the process of developing a new government agency during the time that legislation was being proposed or drafted to make the agency permanent. This has often been done as a fulfillment of a campaign idea or promise. In one of his early press conferences in 1961, President Kennedy announced that he'd use an executive order to establish the Peace Corps. Here's a clip from that press conference.
I have today signed an executive order providing for the establishment of a Peace Corps on a temporary pilot basis. I'm also sending to Congress a message opposing authorization of a permanent Peace Corps. This corps will be a pool of trained men and women sent overseas by the United States government or through private institutions and organizations to help foreign countries meet their urgent needs for skilled manpower. It is our hope to have between 500 to 1,000 people in the field by the end of this year. We will send Americans abroad who are qualified to do a job. We will send those abroad who are committed to the concept which motivates the Peace Corps. It will not be easy. None of the men and women will be paid a salary. They will live at the same level as the citizens of the country which they're sent to, doing the same work, eating the same food, speaking the same language. We're going to put particular emphasis on those men and women who have skills in teaching, agriculture, and in health. I'm hopeful that it will be a source of satisfaction to Americans and a contribution to world peace.
And finally, here's audio of President Reagan in March 1981, relatively soon after taking office, announcing an executive order that was an attempt to eliminate fraud and abuse in government departments. Although not as dramatic as Ike's Little Rock speech or as ideological as JFK's Peace Corps announcement, it shows that executive orders have been used to solidify the promises made by presidential candidates.
Today, I'm announcing two actions to respond to the demand of the American people for honesty in government. While numbers of thousands of government employees are working honestly and competently to serve their nation, there is also a very small minority of dishonest and some frankly incompetent individuals who are costing the taxpayers perhaps billions of dollars in fraud and waste. Now, this is not my money. It's not the Congress's money. It's the people's money. Our failure to stop this fraud, waste, and mismanagement has led to growing public cynicism about the ability of government to control itself. It raises fundamental questions about the integrity of government. My first action is the issuance of an executive order establishing the President's Council on Integrity and Efficiency. And this action signals everyone who works for or does business with the government that we mean business. The executive order I will sign brings together in one body the inspectors general of the various agencies of government so that they can focus their total efforts in the places that will do the most good.
Executive orders, buzzkillers, have the force of law unless, that is, a court steps in and determines that a specific order is unconstitutional. Usually courts don't do this because presidents make sure that their proposed executive orders have been hammered out by smart government lawyers and scholars and have been given a defensible basis in previous congressional law and executive branch tradition. An exception is President Truman's 1952 attempt to mediate a labor dispute by nationalizing the steel industry temporarily through executive order was struck down by the Supreme Court because it was seen as unconstitutional. But that usually doesn't get, those things usually don't get to that level. Executive orders have a very complicated and in many ways controversial role in American government, and the history of their development is anything but clear. Don't let the journalists tell you otherwise. Listen to the good professor here. Although many Americans like to think that the U.S. Constitution is written in stone and that the intent of the framers is clear, the way executive orders have developed shows that it isn't. We just don't know whether the framers deliberately wrote the articles and sections relating to executive action in general terms in order to give the president room to maneuver. We also don't know whether they thought that executive action was an easily comprehensible thing, especially in the limited sense of 18th century governance, and that succeeding generations wouldn't find it controversial. And although President Trump's travel ban executive order has been deemed unconstitutional by a lower court, we'll have to see whether it gets appealed to the Supreme Court. Well, the whole thing certainly has all of America inundating the Buzzkill Institute with requests for clarification and historical context. I hope that this episode helps clarify a very unclear aspect of American history and governance. We'll see what happens next week, Buzzkillers. Over and out. Epicast.